that are continuing to go out. Burbank just got $500 million for its plan. Those are funds that are out there. So it's really aligning what you want as a city to what funding sources are out there, and then making the highest and best use of the transportation funds. Also, just as a reminder, this is the one revenue stream that cannot be touched by Sacramento or the feds or anybody else. It can only be used for the specific purpose for which voters approve it, if they do, which is the transportation funds as specifically laid out in the expenditure plan. Not for new staff, not for any of those other things, but for the projects and programs.
And that's what makes it a specific tax. That's why we have to do the 3/4 majority.
Correct. 2/3.
Councilman Bausch.
So when we sat down with James a couple weeks ago, I really appreciate the 55% local, I appreciate the 40% regional, appreciate the 4% seniors. I really appreciate the 1% admin cap. Going back a couple of years, the last time Slocog took a bite at this sales tax, the local perception was that the county failed to provide monies for roads. They shifted the funding to the unhoused. Whether or not that's a valid observation or not, the point that I was trying to make with James is that the perception is that Slocog is a county organization. How would you change that perception today? And how would you answer critics that say the county has failed to provide for roads?
So it's really not unique to San Luis Obispo County or to Slocog. To be honest, if you ask the average person on the street, whatever their cog is, they have no idea.
Right.
they just don't. I mean, it's really like, oh. But two things. One, Slocog is not the county, and that becomes education, which we'll be working on over the next, 10 months. Slocog is you. It is all of the various agencies together. It's the sandbox by which local agencies play in to develop policies and programs linked to transportation. As it pertains to the county, and we hear this all the time, more often from the counties, not just San Luis Obispo, from all over, Madera, Stanislaus, Merced, I've worked on all of them. The challenge is that they have more road miles, and very oftentimes the priorities that people want in their neighborhood may not be the same priorities that the county staff puts together. And we, as Slocog, can't control any more than we control with you which roads you choose to pave or do first. But that's one of the reasons that in this particular measure, we've included provisions that say they have to go out to the community advisory councils. They have to show how they're going to spend their money before they spend it. So at least there's a public process. And for you, and it's in the same thing for you guys, again, most people, when they look at the annual budgets for the county or for the city, you know that you're getting, well, staff knows you're getting all these funds from different places.
Right.
The public does not. That just, for them, it just kind of, their eyes roll over, right? So it's required to call out whatever this measure is, A, B, C, D, Q, whatever, that this is how we're going to spend our money this year. And that's one of the reasons that we sort of upped the transparency, the oversight, all those things in this particular measure in the expenditure plan, so people could see that there was really a concerted effort to make that happen. And again, not suggesting that anyone was doing anything untoward or bad, but just to make sure that with these funds, there'd be no question about how they were spent or the process by which an agency decided to spend them.
And I think that's really important as you go through your marketing over the next 10 months, that is a bright light you shine on the difference between the county and what Slocog is, however you do that. And just go back, because I was remiss, I forgot to mention Ann when she came up to give the presentation. She was a big part of that, so
yeah.
I apologize.
That's awesome. And also just a word of caution, and your attorney will probably tell you this as well. We are not ever going to do a marketing program on this. Education. It's all about education. And the words matter because we cannot use public funds in any way, shape, or form to advocate one way or the other for any of these things. All we can do is educate the public about what's in this measure, what it potentially can do for those communities, and answer those questions. So I just, you as an individual and as elected, we hope you do go, but we can't.
As a veteran of bond measures, I know better, so I stand corrected.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions then of council? Let's go ahead and open it up then to the public. Anybody wishing to address this item, come forward, please. Okay, do we have anybody online?
Yes, sir, we have Linda George.
Okay, copy. Linda, do you hear us? Go ahead.
Yes, Linda George, 3126 Spring Street. I think somebody missed the real big elephant in the room. A tax that is going to be 30 years with no sunset clause. Okay, I'm always afraid when a non-government entity handles a big pot of money for multiple different agencies. You may say that the expenditure plan is in place and it may can only go to this particular plan. Okay, so my question is, why would we do business with you if we can do it ourselves? I mean, I have not seen the staff fail in the money that they've handled so far. So, you know, I was cruising along listening tonight. I forgot I had to go out of town tomorrow. And this 30 years with no sunset clause, just, I'm gobsmacked. How could you ask me, that's my scale, for $2.31 a week for the next 30 years and say, hey, well, you know, if you don't use your money this year, we'll give it to Arroyo Grande. Well, I personally don't want to pay a tax for Arroyo Grande to have money. So I'm a little, I've been remiss. I have never listened intently to a slow clock presentation, but you're talking about a new tax, 30 years, no sunset clause, and it may or may not benefit us. It almost seems like what I like to call a Gavin Newsom scam. My dream job, everybody needs to understand, my dream job was to be a fraud investigator for Social Security. And I just said to somebody, my fraudar is going off. It's a 5-alarm fire. Why would we trust a non-government independent agency with, I probably self-appointed, it sounds like the JPA. I don't want my money to go to you. But please explain this 30 years, no sunset, and we can add things and bells and whistles to it when the 10-year review period comes up. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else online?
No, sir.
Okay. We might want to bring up, let's talk about that for a second, too. That was something that we should address. Again, this is, again, not for our council to decide, but this is going to be a voter-approved type of situation for the whole county. So what did SLOCOG, and why did they figure a 30-year term?
Okay, so for it, I just want to be clear. It has a sunset clause. It is sunsetting at 30 years. If the public wanted to sunset it sooner than that, they could always take out another measure to take it out to the voters and it could be closed earlier, but it is a set time of 30 years. The other thing I want to point out is that the way we're looking at the slide right now, that when the funds come in, they are allocated by the state of California based on the percentages that I've just gone over to each of the agencies. So the Paso Robles money cannot go to Arroyo Grande or to anybody else. It has to just go to Paso Robles exactly the way that it's laid out. So there is no change on that. And SLOCOG actually is functionally sort of like a joint powers authority. And the reason for that is because the federal government in the 70s actually decided that any place that had population over, I think it was 50,000, had to form a group of agencies in order to be able to acquire federal dollars. And the reason for that is the federal government didn't want to deal with each of the cities. They wanted to deal with one agency. So metropolitan planning organizations or regional transportation organizations exist all over the country. They're not unique to California. They're everywhere. And in this particular case, I would also say that if you want information about how these have worked in California, self-help counties.org lists all of the agencies over the last 25 years that have formed self-help counties shows the amount of money that they've brought in, the projects they've delivered, and of those, not one of them has fallen off in terms of misappropriation of funds or any weirdness like that. So the reason that SLOCOG is doing it is really on behalf of all of the cities and the county of which its board are the members. And staff basically just serves at the pleasure of that board in the same way that your staff serves at the pleasure of council. So it's not an extra layer of government. It's basically a requirement of government in order to access both state and federal funds for transportation.
Okay, understood. Okay. Chris, we'll close public comment, but if you got one real quick question, go ahead. Go ahead, Chris. Yeah, come on.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure being at the meeting tonight. And
like old times, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And I think of Norma. Geez, we, 30-some years ago, I don't know how it happened, but we, and I don't know what role we played, but she became the Main Street manager. And
Norma, all right.
We sort of felt responsible for that, but so we all miss her. But at any rate, I'm your CTAC representative to the COG, and it's been that way for about 20 years, I think. And it just, you know, what really strikes me is how the other counties have been able, all the counties surrounding us, except for San Luis Obispo County, have been able to take advantage of this self-help business, and they've raised millions of dollars. And you know, these major projects, the Union Road overpass or underpass, or the intersections at 46 East or West, there's going to have to be some kind of, something will happen at Golden Hill and 46. There are just a number of these different things. And the only way to pay for it that I can see is by getting the grants. I mean, that's what you have to do.
Right.
And this self-help is, I think, the only way to do it. It's painful, you know, it's any kind of a tax is hard, but I mean, we're just missing out if we don't take advantage of it. Thank you very much.
You bet. Thank you, Chris. Yeah, I agree. I totally agree. Again, we live in California, and that's the structure of the way money is appropriated to do big projects, unfortunately, here. So it's going to be up to the voters. This is not a council decision. All we're doing is receiving a file tonight. And it's going to be something that SLOCOG's going to put on the ballot for all the people to vote up or down. So I think we're good unless we have other questions for the representative. But if nothing else, I was going to go ahead and receive and file.
No, that's fine. I'm going to receive and file. I was going to comment on the money going in. And that is, it's a half cent, I guess, or approximately, isn't it? Half cent. But who's paying for it? Actually, our citizens in Paso Robles are paying for a very small percentage of that because it's on the type of things that tourists buy, number one. We know that 40% of that is that from our own experience. But of the other 60%, that is calculated on the basis of not including any of the zip codes in our own county. So if you exclude all those zip codes, then that's the 60%. But if you exclude those zip codes, then you're also not figuring in as tourist money or as outside our city money all the people who in the county that don't live in the city who still come here to buy, come here to eat in our restaurants, come here to buy, go to our stores that sell things that are taxed, go in here to buy a car, et cetera, things like that.
Yeah.
And I know this happens because even when I have purchased something outside of the city, on my bill from, well, I got a bill just this week from a store that I did business with down in Laguna Hills. In my bill was Paso Robles city tax. And I paid that, but I paid it even though I went all the way down there. So that money still came to us too. So it's amazing how little we have to pay into this in order to get the benefit.
Yeah.
Our citizens, that is.
No, I think our residents definitely figured it out because we had our J20 money and, you know, our those tax overrides that we did float in our city, and the Robelands approved it. Although, again, it was a 50% plus one, this is a two-thirds vote, which is going to be a little higher to achieve. So we'll see what the county and all the other cities are going to do with it. So thank you for being here tonight. All right, moving on. Then we have the annual comprehensive financial report, fiscal year 24-25. Ryan Cornell.
Good evening, Mr. Mayor and City Council. Ryan Cornell, Administrative Services Director. Tonight, to present to you our annual comprehensive financial report, commonly referred to as ACFR. We like our acronyms. Okay, so state law requires every general purpose government local agency to publish within 6 months of year end a complete set of audited financial statements. So this ACFR fulfills that state requirement. The ACFR is prepared in accordance with general accounting procedures as well as the Government Accounting Standards Board. It really is the best method of comparing apples to apples financially speaking with other agencies. This year, the financial statements were audited by Moss Levy & Hartzheim. They are a CPA firm out of Santa Maria. They specialize in auditing local school districts, municipalities, nonprofits, and the like. Management is actually responsible for all the numbers and all the reports in the financial report. The auditors are verifying that the numbers are reasonably accurate, not absolutely accurate. Obviously, we cannot look at every single transaction that occurs at the city, so we have internal control mechanisms so that we know, generally speaking, that the revenues are being recorded properly and expenses are being recorded as well. This year, as similar to prior years, there were no specific audit findings or recommendations that was presented. The ACFR is broken down into three kind of major sections. They are the introductory section, the financial section, and the statistical section. Pages 1 through 13 is the introductory section. It just kind of provides that very high level overview of city activities, information that we kind of see moving forward, as well as kind of the economic indicators. But the bulk of the report, and I'll kind of go over it in a few more slides, is that financial section. It's pages 15 through 175. And that really includes every single financial report or statement that the city produces. It reports on every single fund. It combines information and rolls up different components. And then lastly is the statistical section, and that provides more of a historical aspect. It shows like 10-year historical trends, some city demographics and the like. So some components you'll see in the audit are these different changes in position when we look from 1 year to the next. I should take a step backwards and emphasize that this report is for financial transactions that happened on July 1st, 2024 and ended on June 30th, 2025. And so it is 6 months in the rears, and so we are looking at old data. So when I present budget information, we kind of estimate what it's going to be during these numbers. These numbers are finally finalized, but there isn't really much of a change by the time I do budget preparations and by the time we get here. But in this case, this is net positions. This is everything. This includes water, wastewater, all the utility funds. So this is things in totality. So unrestricted net position, which essentially is reserves, increase slightly from 1 year to the next. Restricted reserves, that means that it's money that we have held, but they're for a specific purpose, like development impact fees. We can only spend those on infrastructure expansion. There wasn't really much of a change from 1 year to the next. And then lastly, and by far the largest, it's not really a reserve, but it's more the position, is in its investments in fixed assets. Those are the capital projects, the infrastructure, and the like. And so we continue to see investments made into those. And so the city's actually able to recognize those as assets and then depreciate it over the life of the piece of equipment or the asset infrastructure. Another one, and this, and I'll actually explain this too, that one of the main differences with ACFRS and more having to do with Government Accounting Standards Board is that we report expenditures and revenues based on functions, not necessarily based on department. And so the main four functions that the city has: general government, public safety, highways and streets, culture and recreation, and I think we have like three or four other little ones. But the blue line on this graph shows the actual expenditures incurred for the year, and the green shows the actual direct program revenues those functions provided. So for example, public safety, we do get some grants, we do charge for certain services from them, but the vast majority of the expenses are covered with taxes. And so that's what this graph shows, is that if it wasn't for taxes, we wouldn't be able to fund city programs. And really, this is kind of the level that taxes subsidize each one of these functions. One other item I want to kind of point out to, and kind of unique to Warren's Department in Community Development, because there's three major functions there. It's planning, engineering, and building. Interestingly enough, when it comes to functions, planning is a general government function, engineering is a streets and roads function, and building is a public safety function. And so even though it's centralized on our side and budget purposes under one department, it is broken out separately for ACFRS purposes. Specifically on the general fund, similar to net position, we look at things specifically at the general fund. The general fund had actually decrease in unassigned fund balance. That is the intentional withdrawal of reserves to fund certain capital projects. And so that is indicative there, just under $18 million last year, down to $16 million this year. Side note, when he looks at a percent of revenues, it's right around 33-34% is that $16 million figure. Assigned fund balance, that just means it's money that we've already budgeted or appropriated, just hasn't been spent yet. And so we got after some of those carryover projects. And then non-spendable, that tends to be your prepaid expenses or some of your loan receivables that you can't really spend, but it's still considered an asset. Those don't really move from one year to the next. We do report supplemental sales tax, so that is our measure J20 and I-24 now. So this is what actual expenditures were incurred from 24 to 25. So for police services, an additional $4.5 million in 24 and $3.5 this year. For fire and emergency services, because we finished the fire station 3, it increased from one year to the next. This year was just under $4.5 million. And then you can see on the very last set of columns, road maintenance had a significant increase in funding this last year as well. Similar to general funds, similar to the overall, we look at each of the enterprise funds. We have about five or six enterprise funds. Water, wastewater, and airport are the three major ones. We also have a transit fund. The parking fund is still lingering around in this particular report, but we'll kind of see that drop off in the next couple of years. But you can see from this graph, both wastewater and water funds had significant net position growth. That's indicative of the rate increases that we approved about 5 years ago. So we're seeing revenue still increasing and expenditures kind of leveling off. And then in the airport fund, you'll see a drawdown in net position. That's because we are expanding services there. We have had the most FTE counts in the airport since its history. And so we're a little bit ahead, but I'm seeing that the expenditures are starting to flatten out now that we're done expanding and the revenues are starting to catch up to it. So as I mentioned, the ACFRS is a pretty in-depth document. So it includes all of these different things. So even in more depth, if anybody in the public is interested in what the city's significant accounting policies are, they could go to this document and find out. They could find out detailed information about our cash and investments. It's at June 30th, it's a snapshot in time, but it will list all of our US treasuries, what our bonds are, and everything in detail. It goes into details of what capital leases we have, what known receivable we have, and then what we anticipate receiving in the future years. It talks all about all of our long-term debt obligations, including PERS and the unfunded liability there. It includes the unfunded liabilities of the OPEB, the other post-employment benefits that we provide, as well as some activities of the successor agency to the redevelopment agency. now we're at a point where we're just paying debt services, but those transactions are part of the ACFR as well. Councilmember Beal, we had talked a couple weeks ago, or about a month ago, about if we ever see budgets to actuals. We do, and there's supplementary information sections in here. This is specifically on the general fund on page 113. Again, they're not as in-depth as my budget presentations. We have to follow GASB and GAAP requirements. So you see at the very top line there, it's just taxes. Well, that's all taxes. It's sales tax, property tax, TOT. So it's, even though it's only one line in there, that's how the financial reporting works. But when I do the budget presentations, we break it down into those individual details. So just very high level total revenues, we had budgeted 56.2 million. Actuals came in at 56 million, so it was actually under about $200,000 there. But on the flip side, if you look down on expenditures, we had a budgeted appropriations of 54.9 million. I'm just getting kind of far on those numbers. And then actual expenditures of 50.5. So we actually had a budget variance of about 4.4 million. So overall, at the end of the day, there was about a 6.5 net positive to the fund than we anticipated during budget time. We have these budget schedules for, again, the general fund, for the supplemental sales tax fund, the capital projects funds, all the funds. And then lastly, this is just a snippet out of the statistical section. This is full-time equivalents by department, and it's the history, so from 2017 to now. These are actual productive hours worked, so it includes overtime. If there was an FTE that was not filled for a position, it actually lowered that. So as you can see, over the last 3 years since 2023, really since we've passed Measure J20, we've been able to grow our full-time equivalency, mainly in the police and fire in the police and fire ranks, and that's why we see kind of a significant increase. But pretty impressive to see that back in 2017 we were right around 200 full-time equivalents, and now we're a little over 300. One more slide, and I'm going to turn it over to our auditor. So over the last 7 years, we have been submitting our ACFR to the Government Finance Officers Association, GFOA, for reporting of Certificate of Achievement for Excellence Reporting. Those certificates are usually good for only 1 year, so we did receive it last year for June 30th, 2024. We do anticipate, or we are going to submit it again for this fiscal year, so we do anticipate receiving that award again. And then just an additional emphasis, our budget document also received GFOA's financial award for financial presentation. So with that said, my presentation's done. We do have the auditor here from Moss, Levin, Hartzheim, Adam Geis. It's been a couple years since they've got in front of City Council. I thought it was a good opportunity to say a couple words.
Great, thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Hi, as introduced, my name is Adam Geis. I was the partner in charge of the fiscal audit for this last year. Ryan already went over kind of the highlights of the numbers and stuff. There's a ton of detail in there. If you do want to read just a smaller section of it to try and get a good overview, I would highly recommend reading the management's discussion and analysis section, which is towards the front of the report. That the whole purpose of that is to summarize the financial information as well as to provide some analysis for a change from year to year and why some numbers did change. From the audit perspective, the most important thing in here is page 15 through 17, which is the audit opinion on the ACFR. And I wanted to point out that this is an unmodified audit opinion, which is the best kind of audit opinion. Basically, it means that we were able to come out here, do all of our work, test all of the numbers, and that we agree that all the numbers in here are materially supported and accurate. In order to do that, we did make two visits out to the city, two different weeks during the year. The first visit, we obtained an understanding of all of the internal controls, and then we do tests of samples of disbursements, credit card usage, payroll, receipts coming in from various departments, including utilities. And through all of that testing of controls, I'm happy to report that there are no findings, as Ryan briefly mentioned earlier. So, you know, all the controls that we tested, it looked like they were being implemented properly by the city, and that the city has a strong strong internal controls. When we come out to the city the second time, this is what you think of more traditional audit work, where we get all of the final numbers for the fiscal year. We get a lot of backup from them. We test those numbers to make sure that they're supported, test cutoffs of revenues and expenditures to make sure that they're reported in the proper year. And then the numbers that are reported here are the result of all of that work. There is one small piece still remaining of the audit for this year, and that is there's a single audit over the federal spending. The OMB was significantly delayed in putting out their final guidance. It actually just came out like 2 weeks ago for doing the federal testing. So that single audit piece is still left to be done, and that will be done at least by when it's required at the end of March. And you know, when we come out here, we do look at a ton of paperwork, both physical paperwork and stuff scanned into their computer systems. And I just wanted to say that I appreciate all the work from Ryan and Catherine and city staff in order to get us everything that we require to look through the numbers and help them put together this report and the assurance. I wanted to bounce it up back to you guys to see if you guys have any questions.
Adam, I did have a question. Did you see in your audit any flags or things that you might suggest, best practices that change over time that you might have suggested to our financial staff to look at or change or consider?
You know, as we go through and test the numbers, you know, as I said, there was no findings or anything that we needed to report here. You know, as we go through some of the processes and working through things, we do have small recommendations here and there. You know, I don't have any of that information off the top of my head. Mm-hmm. In addition to assisting the city with implementing new guidelines that come along pretty much on an annual basis, mostly with the government auditing or accounting standards boards wanting to add more pages to this already 200 plus page document. But
okay.
Yeah.
Questions of Adam, the auditor, Councilman Bausch.
Thank you. I just looked at a couple of pages on this 113 that Ryan pointed out earlier. I was happy with that. Compared to other cities that you audit, any trends that you're noticing, either with reserves or spending, that I'm pretty comfortable with what I've seen, and I'm comparing that to school districts, so I'm really easily pleased compared to that. But anything that you might notice that we as a council might want to keep an eye on for the future?
Not really. You know, compared to school districts, the city does take in a lot more in terms of service fees.
Sure.
Where school districts are almost entirely supported by governmental funding and taxes. You know, so as long as you keep the fees at levels that you need to, in order to support those activities and support how much, whatever, you know, level of subsidy that the city requires.
Compared to other cities, our reserves seem to be above average.
They seem to be at a good level. You guys do have the supplemental sales tax, which assists a lot in staffing and getting some of those road projects done. So it's nice that you have that to leverage.
And staffing levels don't seem high or out of the ordinary?
They do not. We don't really get too much into the detail on that, but no.
Good. Thank you.
Okay. Any other? Or of Ryan? Okay. Thank you. We'll open up the public. Anybody wishing to address this item, please come forward. Okay. Seeing none, we'll come back. And is there anyone online?
No, sir.
Okay. So this is a receive and file for the annual comprehensive financial report, which includes the independent auditor's report on the city's financial statements for fiscal year ending in June 30, 2025.
I didn't have a question, but I had a general comment.
Sure,
that's
go ahead.
Okay. I thought this was the order. You know, for an organization of this size, I just really want to commend the staff for having the systems and the controls in place to have, when everything's tested, to have everything work out. This is a big organization. There is a lot going on. And just in my short time here and having to submit a credit card receipt, like, there are definitely controls. But the fact that there are no findings, I would think is fairly unusual. You know, usually in an audit, there's something. So congratulations to everyone. I do have a question on the, I'm sorry, I won't ask the question. I'll talk to you later.
Oh, okay. All right, so this is just a receive and file, Fred. I don't think we need a motion, but thank you, Ryan, for your report. A lot of hard work, appreciate that. Thank you. Moving on, item four, we have receipt of the Police and Fire Emergency Service Community Risk Assessment and Standards of Cover Report. Fire Chief Jonathan Stornetta, you have that item? And actually, Damian, I think, are you going to have part of that? It's just, yeah, come on up, David.
Hurry it up. We're going to start timing you.
Good evening, Mayor Hammond, members of the council, Jonathan Stornetta, Fire Chief. We conducted a community risk assessment, standards of cover, recently, and it we conduct it about every 5 years, as well as we create a new strategic plan to go along with it. And this year, for the first time in police department's history, they actually conducted the same assessment with us. And really, it measures not only the hazards in the community, but the risk, and also do we have the proper amount of resources to mitigate those risks and hazards. But we consulted with AP Triton, and I'd like to call up the AP Triton team right now, and they're going to go through the community risk assessment and provide you an overview, and then we'll be happy to answer any questions afterwards. So up first is Kurt Latipau. He's representing the fire department, and he's a former fire chief here locally and throughout the state.
Yeah,
welcome.
I'm going to tag team this. So
okay.
I've got my partner in crime, Mark Petzer, with me. Partner in crime, get it? Never mind. So thank you very much for this opportunity to present hopefully a quick overview. It's late in the evening. You guys have had a big agenda of these two very, very important reports. It was one project broken down into two reports. And I can't see. The team, we are two of eight. We had eight subject matter experts on this project, all working in collaboration with each other as well as with the police and fire teams. There was a common theme running through the work that we did over the last several months from our team, and that is the impression and the positive impression that our team members had as to the commitment to public safety of your police, fire, and the council and the community. Okay. So real quickly, purpose and overview. This is purpose and overview of a lot of our public safety plans and our studies. We evaluate the risks, and it's interesting as we look at risk across the board. Some folks believe that when we look at the community risk assessment, it only pertains to the fire department, but in actuality, as we did these together and the team members compared notes on risk, we were able to identify risk overall without the community, throughout the community, that impacted both police and fire. From our experience, from my experience, this supports long-range planning, fiscal responsibility, and identifies current performance and future needs, which you'll see here in a minute. So why now? We're preparing for the future, we're preparing for today and into the future. Very aggressive growth, a lot of great things going on in the city, so much so that as we were finishing up this project, I actually moved into the city, and I'm now a property owner.
Oh, great.
So I'm very impressed with my council.
Welcome.
So population growth, new housing, community developments, the expansion of tourism, which is very obvious throughout the community, capital improvement planning, workload capacity. And all this, as you move over to the right side, all this and will impact your service demand increases. Primary, as you have the opportunity to read through roughly 500 pages of study, if you can't get to sleep tonight, but lack of primary care services is identified within this report. We live it, we know it. Our closest hospital is in Templeton. We do have some urgent care centers, but really from a primary care perspective, we're a little shy. You have a homeless strategic plan that is being implemented. However, it is still impacting services throughout the community. Behavioral health is becoming more of a challenge, and a lot of times homelessness, unhoused, goes hand in hand with the behavioral health challenges. Traffic demand, traffic fire flows, to realize what's going on, you just need to drive through our community. And then the care facilities, the skilled nursing facilities, the daycares. I had an opportunity to visit the senior daycare with my therapy dog the other day and was very impressed with the service being provided there. So why now? It's interesting as we look at this chart. This is what's in the pipeline. That's what's known in the pipeline. Pipeline's growing. Pipeline is still having inputs. What's not in here yet is the results of the state statutes that mandate the consideration for ADUs and junior ADUs, which from our perspective in the public safety arena and all city services will have an impact on risk and will have an impact on demand. So from the pipeline perspective, this is what's happening within, I'll talk about the fire department first. So as we look at the pipeline and as we try to calculate the impact of what's in the pipeline today on the fire side, you'll see from lodging, you'll see from dwellings, your population increase, and as you total up the annual calls from all these at all three fire stations, it totals 4,372 calls on an already busy system. This system has increased roughly 25% since 2019 on the fire side. Mark?
Thank you, Kurt. Yes, and echoing that on the law enforcement side, I mean, with a projected increase of population of 42%, calls for service, obviously within law enforcement services, are going to go up, both community-generated law enforcement or calls for service as well as police-initiated calls for service. And so to maintain, based on the demand that we've seen and the current workload we've seen to maintain services that you've become accustomed to from law enforcement, that the citizens, from everything we can tell, are very happy with, you're looking at an increase of officers of up to nearly 100 officers to handle a workload of 30,000 calls for service per year, just community-generated calls for service. That's not including police-initiated. Now, keep in mind that is projected out to 2045, and that would change in between. You know, obviously there'd be some adjustments in between, but that's the projection looking at and the development impacts on law enforcement.
So what are we measuring? What is the standard of cover measuring? It's all up there. Community risk, hazard analysis, and as you thumb through the standard of cover, it's extremely depth. It makes a look at population. We do a lot of analysis comparing what's going on in the city with some state trending. You'll see a little bit of that in a few minutes. The deployment response capability, stations, resources, not just on the fireside, but law as well. Response performance, how does it compare? How does it benchmark? Workload and reliability and the impact of your concurrent calls, we'll talk about those in just a minute. And at the end of the day, if you will, or to sum this up, the intent is to align risk and projected demand with your available resources. So key findings on the fire study, you'll find the detailed key findings on page 201, and on the police study, you'll find it on 217. They're all up there for you. I'm not going to read them, but the importance of findings in these types of studies is the findings are data-driven. We utilize state, local, such as Paso Robles standards, as well as nationally recognized standards to develop the findings. The findings in this particular case, all the findings you see up here, and there's more in the study, drive recommendations. We do not make recommendations off the seat of our pants. We pride ourselves on doing deep dives into the analytics. So this is just some example of some of the key findings. You'll see we have projected the population trends up there. Does this point? Jonathan, no. Does it point?
Sorry.
Oh. That's pretty high tech.
That's a pretty good point.
Trying not to mess it up. Okay, that is not working. There. Okay, never mind. Up in the upper left, you'll see the projected increase in population and as it compares to calls. And again, this is on the known. Remember, we're looking at a snapshot in time. However, if you look at that particular slide, it's a little small, I agree. It does project out a little ways. So then we move over to the percentage of the vulnerable population by age. And this is rather interesting as you read through the study and take a look at the vulnerabilities. Obviously, I was a little surprised because I'm in that middle group there. But we're very used to seeing our younger adults and our seniors as being vulnerable. But what's interesting is as you take a look at these is comparing the Paso Robles vulnerabilities to the state average. And here in Paso, we're a little higher. And then when you drop down to the population without health insurance, where, again, Paso Robles is a little higher than the state average. Now, there's all kinds of discussion we can have on what's driving that or what may drive that in the future, which is very concerning as we lose some subsidies. However, some of this may be, in fact, driven by some of the workforce that we have in Paso Robles who does not have access to health insurance. Why is it important? Why is it important to track that particular trend? Because when somebody, it's proven, if somebody doesn't have health insurance, can't afford to go to the ER, they're going to call 911. 911 is the last resort for a lot of people for care. And then as you look at that figure down in the left corner, those are the current ratings for your insurance services office, which actually helps drive some of your insurance policy costs, particularly for single-family residences and your small and medium-sized businesses. The large businesses are self-insured. However, the findings that drive the recommendations, as we look at some of the recommendations, when implemented, some of those recommendations actually have the potential to have a positive impact on the scoring, and possibly you'll see some results the next time MISO comes in to rate you. Key findings for fire again, response workload history. I already mentioned it's gone up 25% since 2019, and you see that charted over there. You'll also see a travel time chart here up in the upper right. The preferred travel time is adopted is 4 minutes. However, when we look at station locations, when we look at resources, when we look at traffic, it becomes harder and harder to make those goals. The reality is station locations, resources, and staffing have a direct impact, and the ability for the crews to get out on the road and the condition of the roads have a direct impact on their ability to travel to the incident in a quick manner. And then those two examples there on the bottom, those give you an example of what we call the effective response force. The effective response force numbers are dictated by the department, and these are the number of people, the number of apparatus it takes to respond to, in this particular case, and there are several in the study, in this particular case, to a moderate wildland risk, and you'll see there's a deficit. And then when you move over to the alarm assignments for a high fire risk incident, such as a multi-story, multi-family, or a hotel, there's a deficit there. Some of the recommendations in the plan, in the study, will actually enhance, in a positive way, these results. Simultaneous calls. When we first look at this, when you first look at this chart, some people go to, well, simultaneous calls, it's just, you know, two at the same time. In reality, what we have seen in our study in Paso Robles, it's not just two at the same time. Many times it's three at the same time, sometimes four at the same time, and occasionally five at the same time. Now, you don't have to be a mathematician to figure out, you have three stations, three fire engines, one truck, one squad. You can only handle so many calls at once. So I mentioned the findings drive recommendations. The detail on the recommendations are on page 204 of the fire study, and we'll talk about law in just a minute. I do want to point out that some of these recommendations can tag team with our police department recommendations, so that you can get an economy of scale, such as construction or renovation of fire stations. There's a very positive trend, including here, moving towards co-location of resources. So it's an economy of scale. So when you design a new station or remodel a new station, giving consideration to the needs in that particular area, which Mark will talk about in a minute, for additional locations for substations, et cetera. And in particular, as you look at renovating or replacing Station 2 being the oldest station in the community, and definitely the demand has exceeded the capability of that particular station. And then as you look at some of the maps and some of the call concentrations in the study, you'll obviously see why we're recommending a station number 4. That particular area of the community is extremely busy. And then I'm not going to go through all of them, but I do want to comment on the last box there. Measure J20 was mentioned earlier in a couple of other presentations. During our analysis, and there's a really strong finance section that actually I know for sure that our finance SME worked very closely with your finance department. I believe that section is very complimentary. However, in looking at the finances, in interviewing the leadership, and recognizing the value of that particular measure, it's extremely important that you consider pursuing an early renewal of that so you can continue your positive trajectory. So all of our studies are very interesting. It's a snapshot in time when we start. Once the data is loaded, that snapshot closes and we start our analysis. And it is not unusual, and certainly not been unusual here, that as we move through the study and as we work hand in glove with the city's team, that they start to tick off some of the things that we're already starting to pick up, because we don't work in a vacuum. We're very open as we have these discussions throughout the study. So we did recommend from a risk perspective and for an enhancement of effective response force that the truck be fully staffed and moved to Station 1. When you look at our risk maps, it's very obvious why you'd want to move that down to Station 1. It's the core. And when you move the truck to Station 1, it actually gives it a much better response footprint. The fire inspection program is already being aligned with the NFPA standards. Special event planning is being fine-tuned. Fire prevention training, we did make some recommendations for enhancements in fire prevention training. That's going on. The business community outreach from a community risk reduction perspective. Community risk reduction is everybody. It's not just the fire department. It's everybody in the community is ongoing. The curriculum's being implemented. The airport security plan is being complied with. And then the engagement in the community is being tracked. So these are all things that now have already started to move forward in a very positive way.
Right. Now, working off that foundation that Kurt mentioned of all, obviously, the reasons of conducting this and looking at a snapshot of the law enforcement side of this, first, a study like this has to look far beyond just a simple number of officers. Too often we see if a municipality or jurisdiction is going to look at staffing numbers at all, they look at it, they try to slap a per capita formula on the number of officers needed, and that's really inaccurate way to determine a number of officers needed for workload demand. And so the following slides are just a couple representations of the many areas we looked at in the staffing analysis of the police department. And really, it's barely a representation of the 120 pages of the data analysis section in that report that you have. Oops, go back. So first, we're looking here on the left. We see a spatial distribution of the calls for service. We're looking beyond just a simple calls for service number. We want to know where those calls for service are happening at. Of course, this it's not just about what numbers we have. It's about how we're deploying those numbers of officers, where we're deploying them. And so this is going to help us more for our later analysis. On the right here, and these two charts are not necessarily related. They're different parts in the analysis. But on the right, we see a breakdown of call priorities by beat. So the city's broken down into four quadrants. Within those quadrants are different sectors. But then for police, for law enforcement services, is broken down into two beats, beat one and beat two, on the west side of 101 and then on the east side of 101. And so we can look at those calls based on all the CAD data that we received. We look at the calls on priority one, priority two, priority three. Of course, priority one being your more urgent calls, and priority three being the less urgent calls, and priority two in the middle there. And I get a better understanding of what beats, what areas are generating what types of calls. And here we see really a relatively even distribution, which is important to know that the demand is pretty much even throughout the city of what we're seeing. Moving on in this, a couple more examples here. We have on the top left community-generated calls for service by call group. So all of the 42,000 plus calls that were analyzed for the study, it was about a 2-year period of CAD data we looked at, were broken down into these call groups. Again, looking at them by district or by quadrant, your quadrant 1 through 4, and we get an understanding of what quadrants are creating what types of calls for service. Again, relatively evenly distributed. Quadrant 3, your northwest or northeast corner, a little less, but we anticipate, obviously, as that gets more and more developed, that's where more of your demand's going to come out of. Another area we look at in the bottom left is on some of the staffing requirements. It's beyond, our law enforcement services go beyond, you know, just going how many calls for service and the time on those calls. There's a lot of ancillary time built into that. For instance, on there you see during this time frame there was 879 transports to the county jail. And behind that number, though, is a minimum of 2 hours for each of those transports from officers. So there's thousands of hours behind that simple number that we have to account for when we look at these analysis. And that goes beyond just the patrol requirements like you see there, whether that's transport to local holding or the county jail. It's also looking at sick leave usage or PTO, other administrative time, training, court, and such. And then lastly, another area that we look at is the response times. We look at call handling times and call response times. How quick are we getting to different areas of the city? How efficient is the PD to get there? And again, this is important to understand. And every jurisdiction we see is slightly different based on geographics and how the city's laid out. Here you see a very defined line between the west side of 101 and the east side of 101, where response times greatly increase on the east side. And again, as Kurt mentioned before, this is the data that drives our recommendations, and we'll speak about that here in a moment. So these are just some of the different areas that the staffing analysis, like I said, is about 120 pages of that analysis for looking at call loads to make the recommendations and the findings that we had. Now, the recommendations on the law enforcement report start at page 222, you want to take a look at that. And again, I'm not going to go through each and every one of these. They're in there in great detail, both the finding and the recommendation. But to talk just on a couple of them, developing the East Side facility and really conducting the facility's master plan, talking about them together. In our study, we've identified basically that the city or the PD's outgrown their facility. For the amount of officers they have, they've outgrown the facility. This